So let's just get started with Holger.
So thank you very much, Ron, and thanks for the invitation. I'm supposed to answer questions about small molecules and reliable startup models, and I think small, big, reliable, that all comes together at one point. So I think it's important that we have sort of dynamic molecules in solution that are not stabilized by any crystal contacts, and I think that's the important part, that we have to address this kind of possible flexibilities and dynamic aspects in our macromolecules. And I think it's also rewarding because we can learn a lot from these dynamic aspects of our macromolecules. And I would also like to show you that I don't have a small molecule to show you that. It's a ribosome. So you will, again, have to suffer a bit from ribosomes here today. What is that? Does it work? Oh, yeah. Okay. So the traditional way of how we all deal is that we use the single particle cryo-EM in a way that we use thousands and thousands, an increasing number of particle images to get a single three-dimensional structure. And I think this is already the problem it worked out very well for many of the complexes in the past, when you have very homogeneous complexes, very well defined, and we have looked at many of these very well behaved complexes in the past already. But what happens if you have complexes that more or less look like that, and you have seen such kind of movies in many of the presentations already from Stan, especially very very nice ones. So you see that there might be some parts of the molecule that are stable, and then you have dynamic things, variations in your structure that go on. And the same is true for, why does this not work? For very large complex, like, for example, the spliceosome, which is one of our major objects that we try to study. So if you have these kind of variations in one single data set, and these movable elements or dynamic elements are larger than just a small coil that flips out somewhere. If you have, say, like here, for example, one third of the part that is really in very different conformations, then the problem is that you can no longer try to determine a single 3D structure. If you do so, then all the programs that you have available will just try to misinterpret the different conformations at different rotation angles, and you will end up with errors in your map. And so that's a substantial problem we have. And so what we need to do, instead of just getting one 3D structure, is we have to determine, I think, all the underlying 3D structures that are present in our data set. And we have to do that at the very beginning in our data and processing phase, so that we avoid making mistakes by just putting all those images together into one 3D structure that is not existing. The question is, how can you do that? So you need image processing tools to do that, and you need, of course, higher statistics when you start sorting these images. Then the question is, do we need 100,000 or millions of images? So that's the sort of problem we have. So why is it at all so difficult? And it is difficult because we can easily separate these images within fractions of a second, and we can see that there's hardly any similar molecular image in here. So if we transform that in kind of a pseudo model of 2D projections, then you see how difficult it becomes. So if you have such a beautiful preparation on your grid, then you would argue this is an aggregate, this also, but here are nice molecules, and I pick those, and they have the same shape. I try to get a reconstruction of those. But how can you tell whether this is a completely different molecule, a different orientation? You can't, because of the noise and because it's a 2D projection image. So as long as we just try to combine all these images, we will end up with something that may have even not been present in the sample. So the problem is, and we or all phasing there, we have to determine already so many parameters for our image analysis. And we, in addition to that, to these translational and rotational parameters that we have to deal with, we have this high noise level and basically an unknown number of conformational states of our molecule. So if you start a project where you know your complex already very well, or it's known by X-ray crystallography, this is not a big problem. You can overcome that. But if you start a new project with a relatively small complex or something that is not at all characterized, then you may easily end up with tremendous errors in your map. So how to overcome that? So we have seen that already a couple of times. There's different levels of heterogeneity that we have in our sample. So there's what I call structural heterogeneity, and that can just come due to any purification problems that you have. You can lose certain proteins in your complex during purification. You can damage your sample during specimen preparation for EM. And you can have conformational heterogeneity just by having domains that are flexible, or that you just look at an average of your structure being in different conformational and functional states. This is something that you can mostly address already by biochemistry, but there's a certain limit. So it's not easy to purify complexes to a absolutely homogeneous population, especially if they're getting bigger and bigger. Then also the X-ray crystallography approaches are no longer very helpful, because you can also easily purify. You can try to purify it better and better and better, but you can also purify these complexes to death. And so that's a very common problem, and I think many people are facing similar problems right now here. There's these conformational problems. This is something that is also very difficult to deal with in terms of biochemistry. So it can certainly be dealt with to a certain extent, but you can never get rid of it completely. And that is something you definitely need to analyze by new ways of dealing with the images. So we have done some work on trying to prevent problems already here in the initial sample preparation phase. And you've heard a couple of things about these graphics, stabilization of molecules. Let me just quickly show how that works. What we usually do is we have, for these vetri complexes, we have a tube which we use in a glycerol centrifugation run, and there is a glycerol gradient in addition to a fixation gradient, and then while you run the centrifuge, the molecules run into an increasing amount of glycerol, become stabilized, and then you can fractionate that from the bottom. That gives you very clean samples for negative stain. It gives you really very good negative stain samples. And you can also do, from the stabilized fractions, you can easily do a buffer exchange and go straight into cryo. So you can use the method for both, for going to negative stain or for cryo-EM. And the reason why we did it is because we figured out that most of our complexes, and these are mostly related to splicing, and there is lots of different splicing complexes. They look like that on the grid, and I think that is something you always see when you get a new sample. It's an asymmetric complex. Then you see the large complexes, but also minor things that float around, and that means you already destroy your complex somehow on the grid, so something goes wrong. And if you look here, this is after this stabilization, then you see, first of all, we have really usually much better image contrast, and we don't see a huge amount of these smaller broken pieces flying around. So the idea of this technique is basically to prevent the most serious error that can happen, that you lose major parts of your complex, creating an extra mass which causes, again, additional problems in the image processing phase, which you don't want to have. There's, of course, always some concern. Do you modify your structure with this chemical fixation? Of course, you probably do. But is that causing more artifacts than particles that fall apart on the grid? I would argue strongly against it. So it's probably good to start with that. And if you're worried about the chemical fixation, you can then try to later relax it or don't use it. But first of all, one should always take care that the sample stays intact and does not break apart on the grid already. So one problem we had is once you have stabilized your samples already on the grid in these gradient fractions, then it's very difficult to analyze the composition anymore. So what are you dealing with? So that's another important issue. You can no longer run SDS gels because they're fixed and they just get stuck to the gel at the top. And you don't know anything anymore about the composition. So we have developed a new method. We call that ECAD. That means EM, carbon film-assisted endoproteinase digestion. So what we actually do is we take these fractions, we bind them to carbon films, we then do dissociate them. We can then digest the molecules directly with trypsin, and then we apply them to mass spec analysis, and we very nicely find all the peptides, and we can analyze all the molecules that we have on the grid directly. That works very nicely, and it also tells us, since we use glutaraldehyde and trypsin, so wherever we have a modified lysine because of the glutaraldehyde, we should not be able to digest it by trypsin. And since we see that we can digest our complexes still with trypsin and analyze it, it means that at least the way we do this fixation, it's not a complete fixation, it's only partially, and so we can still analyze the samples this way. Is that any good?
You want questions in the...
Yeah, just ask, yeah.
So but what you just brought up, that it's not completely cross-linked.
Yeah.
You can characterize that by SDS.
No, not with glutaraldehyde, no.
Well,
this gets stuck.
We find
it's an irreversible cross-link.
Usually things are not cross-linked. Different subunits of a complex are different degrees. So
you may be lucky that you find some parts that you can see on the SDS chain, but not everything. And most of the complexes we have tried this, they got stuck at the top of the gel.
But then that means they're completely cross-linked.
No, it's just that under normal SDS. You can try to use.
My question really was, I think you answered it already. What do you see if you run SDS?
Oh, yeah, mostly they get stuck at the top of the gel, so they just don't separate.
And just as another comment, there's a gel system that was described in probably the late 80s that's an agarose linear acrylamide system. It's designed to separate with SDS incredibly large complexes. And people might find that useful because it's a lot more low tech than the mass spec stuff, just as a
you can't.
This is a first way of looking at things.
But once it's cross-linked, it's no longer accessible to SDS page. You don't see the proteins anymore.
It's because it's so big.
No, because you can't separate your protein anymore. It's just cross-linked. Just to make sure, and that's one thing, you can then just use the same. You have the same thing. You bind the molecules to the carbon film, and that means everything you have later on your grid, and you put into your microscope, and you try to get the structure from. This is the same thing you analyze in the mass spec. It's not something that is different. And surprisingly, what we have found is that if you use this method, it's much more sensitive than in solution digest. So if you do the in solution digest, and this is just showing you the frequency of detection in colors here of the peptides that we see, and red means we find many, many peptides reproducibly in the experiments, then you see already at a very low concentration using these particles bound to carbon film, we detect all the peptides that we need, whereas in solution, you don't see that. You need much higher concentration in solution. You don't believe it? Yeah? I'm not sure that we have done that. So probably we should see them. I mean, I'm not sure that we have done that.
Yeah. How quantitative is it, Holger, in the sense that can you tell that all the subunits are there in all of the complexes?
Oh yeah, I show you in a second. There's another question. Oh, no, it's not stained. I mean, it's not stained. But you can use, why should you do it? I mean, you just use the carbon film, allow the particles to bind, and then you can take another film, do the same thing, and stain this one. But it's you can't use it, the stained version for that one, and it's not necessary. I think it's one explanation might be if you have particles in solution and you start digesting them, you open them up and you open hydrophobic surfaces. They may just aggregate and they are no longer really very nicely accessible to digestion. So that may be one reason. And if you have them bound to carbon film, they can't move, so they can't form aggregates that are no longer accessible to digestion. That's one explanation.
Just one more quick question, and
but
then I think
have
we better
to move on.
We better move on. Yeah.
There's a lot of more slides.
It's designed to bind hydrophobic things. So with that specimen, it's got hydrophobic binding sites, it's going to bind.
No, we have done it with other samples as well. So we have done it with SNRPs as well. We have just tried to do that for another reason. I go quickly over that because this takes too much time. So we can preferentially detect peptides at interface regions because we once a peptide is cross-linked, we analyze only the non-cross-linked peptides. And if you have lysines in interface regions, you detect them at a higher probability that you can share. But this is just a minor aspect. And one question from Alistair was, you can see here, this is a complex splicing sample. So if you have that and you try to analyze the protein composition, this is always contaminated with some minor protein contaminants that you don't know whether they belong to your structure or not. And if we do that in solution, the red dots here, maybe you can see that they in solution, they are sometimes detected only once or twice, and some of them are already detected five times. If we do that with our method here, then we detect most of the real proteins five times, so we get a high reproducibility of finding the really stoichiometrically bound proteins. So that is also better than in solution. Okay, that's just one aspect. So this is one thing. I just wanted to say it is important to just make sure your particle stays intact when you prepare it for EM. And so that's again to remind you where we are now. I think if you have to consider that there is a freedom in solution to adopt many conformations and many states, then just taking one image is not enough information to deal with all these even unknown parameters in one system. So what we do is we also tilt, but we don't do tomography. We use the random conical tilt imaging. And for those who don't know that in detail, so you just record images. You classify the untilted images. You calculate class averages. And the tilt pairs, the tilt mates of these members of images that end up into one class average, you use only those for calculating the random conical tilt reconstruction. So this is the normal way. It was developed by Michael Rademacher a very long time ago, and we make use of that technique in a slightly different way. So we record now random conical tilt reconstructions of very large number of particles. They're usually between 5,000 and 40,000 tilted image pairs that we use. We record them on the CCD camera. We can do that in negative stain and in cryo. Preferably, we do that now in cryo, but it can be done in both. And what we do, in contrast to normal normal random conical tilt, is we use just about 10 to 40 images to calculate a single three-dimensional reconstruction, which means it's very noisy, but the quality of a random conical tilt reconstruction in terms of how you can be able to distinguish a certain conformation depends on the level of 2D classification in the first step of the untilted images. So if you do, if you include too many images into one class, then the it's already too heterogeneous from the very beginning. So if you have these only noisy random conical tilt reconstructions, so you get you get a few hundred of these noisy random conical tilt reconstructions, but then in order to make sense and to visualize them, you have to align them in 3D. And we have implemented a maximum likelihood-like alignment that is based on Fred's work. It basically works exactly how Fred has described it in his talk. And then we get an alignment of all the volumes in 3D. And after that is done, you still have all the individual volumes, and you don't have to average all of them. So you can then classify them in 3D, and if you really are successful in separating them nicely at the 2D level, they will also be different at the 3D level, and thus you can visualize conformational differences in your structure. So this is how it more or less looks like. You have these random conical tilt 3D structures. First of all, you try to align them by this exhaustive 3D alignment. You only use a rotational alignment, I should say that. We do this weighted averaging, and then you get a more or less consensus structure, which is not always very meaningful because you have conformational heterogeneity or structural heterogeneity. It can be a mixture of both. And then doing the 3D MSA, this is the step that can reveal you all the conformational differences in your map. And you see this guy here is already different in many places, and it was causing us so many problems for so many years. So we never got a reliable reconstruction for this complex, which is the largest and most conserved part of the spliceosome, with angular reconstitution or any other technique, because it's just too dynamic. So when we do that, we try to avoid averaging of volumes that don't belong together. There is no model bias. I'll show you in a minute. We can run that in an automated way. And it's computationally not too demanding because it's just a rotational alignment and it doesn't do the translations in between. I mean, first of all, you have to be able to align it, and once they are aligned, then the MSA, the three-dimensional multivariate statistical analysis can do that. So, but the more difficult step is the alignment of these noisy things, and that's why these maximum likelihood kind of approaches are more powerful, because we are at a lower signal-to-noise ratio. Yeah, of course. I mean, this is not something that works at very high resolution. So it only works at a moderate resolution. And it only gives you some kind of starting models. And it only tells you that if you have these major problems, major rearrangements that usually would cause you lots of errors if you try to combine them in one structure, this is the thing to avoid. And this is what it does. It doesn't tell you all the minor things. So that's different. So, but just to avoid the major errors in the initial structure determining pathway. So this is how it's actually done. So we follow Fred's paper, and what we do is we do these rotational alignments. We evaluate all rotational parameters. We calculate weights for the weighted averaging. Then we have a new model. This is done again and again and again. And we have an additional heuristic weighting step that we have included. And this is goes in here. So when we have really bad volumes, and bad is defined by very low signal-to-noise ratio, and it can happen because you have sometimes, if you have really difficult objects, you may have a bad class that will end up in a random conical tilt reconstruction with very low signal-to-noise ratio. So then we can add this additional weighting function to weight down all these random conical tilt structures that have a very low signal-to-noise ratio. Another weighting we do is now, we haven't done that at the beginning, is we wait for the missing cone, which is not really necessary here, but it speeds up the convergence of the whole process. But it gives the same results if we don't even wait for the missing cone, because our model, if we have different orientations, there is no missing cone in the model. And that means we don't have actually explicitly to treat that. But if we do so, then we get especially better conversion rates for particles that have preferred orientation on the grid. So this is how it looks like for a ribosome. This is very simple. We can do that iterative alignment and averaging even without the maximum likelihood like a weighting scheme that we have here. So you see, starting with a noise reference, it converges to what is really recognizable as a ribosome. And as you will see in the next slide, this is not true for more dynamic complexes like this trisnap that I have already shown you. But what is good with this thing is we start with noise and we get out a structure. And even if we try to fool the program, and this was already nicely shown by Grant yesterday, that he has nicely shown that if you use a reference for the subtomograms and you try to align them, you get out what the reference was. So if we do that with our approach, this is what happens. We can use the ribosome with the wrong-handedness and run these iterations, and what you see is we get the same result. We can even use wrong models like the trisNURB. What comes out is the same result. They only differ in small amounts, so they are not exactly the same, but they just differ in minor details. No, this is tilted data. Yeah. This is tilted data. And the good thing is that if you average them, then you also avoid, if you have lots of different views, then you can avoid having the missing cone. So this is how the structure looks like. There is actually hardly any missing cone. If you have preferred orientation, you always see traces of the missing cone still being there. But for the ribosome, this is clearly completely isotropic structure. It's about a 26 angstrom resolution. And you can give that data set to anybody in the world. What would come out is always the same, the ribosome structure. So this works also for more complex systems and more dynamic systems like the trisNURB. And what you see here is it doesn't work without the maximum likelihood weighting. This does not really converge. Without weighting, it does also not really very nicely work if we have these weighting over all rotational angles. So it still doesn't give us a very good structure. But it works if we switch on the weighting or down weighting of the very badly individual random conical tilt structures as defined by a low signal to noise ratio. So if we do that, then we also get reliable structures here. And then we can do the same thing. So starting with noise gives the same result with the wrong-handedness. And this is already a difficult problem. It's almost a pseudo-symmetry that you see here, but it converges to the right structure. Starting with the ribosome does not reproduce a ribosome, and even if you have symmetrical structure, it converts to the... So those structures are very much similar. And, yeah.
How do you know when it worked and when it didn't?
Oh, when it doesn't work, you get either these completely fragmented densities, or if we had one sample where the dynamic was just too much of dynamics, so it doesn't work for if you have not done your biochemistry. You can't use the soup of everything to do that. If you do that, then you have a ball.
No,
this one you mean?
Yeah, to me it looks good.
To you, it looks good. Yeah. To us, it didn't. It has. You could refine it to higher resolution. Yeah. Okay, that's again. We can then run these 3D MSA, and then we see all these differences in the structure, and that means we have avoided to average all this in the very beginning. We have also done that for this anaphase promoting complex, and that's more. That's one of those complexes that have a continuous movement of. That was the opening and closing thing I have shown you at the very beginning. So it's again here. So this is this kind of movement that we. But again, the question is that different orientations, different conformations? But we can analyze that in our tilt experiments, and if we do so, and then we have refined those structures that came out, and then you can. This is a morphing. So this is just fantasy movie, but it shows you that we can really detect lots of these different conformers in the prep. And then once you know them, you can try to refine them. And it's another question how far you can go from there in terms of getting higher resolution. But at least you avoid, as I've said, averaging over all these things that should not be averaged. So the size-related problem. So we do that all in cryo. That's technically a bit challenging. And all the stuff I have shown you was done on the CM200 with a side-entry Gatan holder, so no fancy microscope. But it can be done. It's just very difficult to do these cryo tilts with molecular weights of less than a megadalton, and I think that is already very, very tricky to do that. The smallest ones we have done with this technique is in the range of about 400 kilodalton, where it still worked. But the problem is, as if you go down in size, then you have, of course, a lower signal-to-noise ratio, higher alignment errors, classification errors, and wrong 3D models. So at a certain moment, you will no longer be able to do also this method. So this is, this is of course, a problem. And I think it's clear that what you really need is to do that reliably is high-quality cryo images. They should have excellent contrast. Face plates would help. Better detectors would help. Also, lower acceleration voltages with small molecules should, of course, also help. But the main thing is, and that is true for large and for small ones, is that I think reliable models can only be done when we look at this variability in our data sets from the very beginning in the initial structure phase, and we avoid the averaging from the first place. And that's also true for any validation tools that needs to be developed. So you cannot assume that there's one structure and validate that. So you have first to say there's so many different structures, at least in a low resolution sense, and then you can validate those. But you can, if you have mixture from the very beginning, a single validation tool that just tries to verify one structure will always fail.
I
come to that point. Yeah. Okay. So what we in contrast to normal RCT, we use a much lower number of particles in that goes into one structure, and that I think makes a difference because there is no good, reliable classification tool that can, with a data set of 5,000 images, classify 200, 300, 400 particles into one class. So you will get already a heterogeneous mixture of everything into that class. And this is how normal RCT works. So, and then you have, in normal RCT, you suffer from, of course, the missing cone problem. Once you have aligned them, different RCTs, this is usually gone. If you have errors in your 2D classification, that can lead to pseudosymmetry problems and also to unreliable 3D models. And one thing, there's problems with classifications are already here at this level when you have, say, such a molecule and you see this guy here is the mirrored version of this one here. And those bolts are up, up, up. This is down, down, down. If you
turn that around, and you don't distinguish between these minor differences at the very beginning in your classification, then you, what you do is, what can happen is that you average this guy with this guy here, and then all the information is gone basically about what's the difference in height of those when you look at the tilted images. That will basically give you a completely flattened structure that has lost all the information in 3D, and you already have these errors. And even worse is if you have spherical objects, and if they are small, then you end up with balls that you can not really consider as real 3D structures. And the problem with that is if you have really small structures, if you get an RCT model just by that and you try to refine that to higher resolution, what you do is you use projection matching like everybody is doing. And the problem is with that if you have a wrong 3D model, I think it can be more easily refined to pseudo high resolution because there's very little overlap with your model and your data. That means there is much room for the noise to align much better than the structural information in your image. And we have actually done that. So we have the overfitting of noise problem, and this is much more serious when you have a wrong model. So these wrong 3D startup models can easily be refined to what is high resolution data, and you see it in the FSC curves, and it was also shown by Nico that this can happen. So this kind of resolution is more image statistics and how much computer power you have, but it has nothing to do with real resolution. And we have done that, for example, for an exosome 3D model we had, which was not a very good biochemical preparation. And our model was clearly not correct, and it was just a single model. And we have used a few hundred thousand raw images and tried to refine that massively by going to very small pixel sizes and a very small angular sampling of your projection images. And we could get an FSC curve showing 5 angstrom resolution at the 0.5 cutoff without any problems for wrong model, and we knew it was wrong, but it showed up all these nice little information. And the problem is this is a relatively small structure, and it's spherical. And
what is it published?
We haven't published it. No. I'm sorry that we didn't publish.
This is a case where you find your whole data set against one
model. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
So it would have been detected if you had split it in two and left some reference.
Just from the very beginning, if they would have never seen each other.
Yeah. We protect.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. Maybe. But if the ball would have been the same ball, then. okay. And this is. So what we do is just trying to make sure with this tilt data that we have, but you can see differences in the 25, 30, 40 angstrom range. So that, and this is important because this is the resolution range that is dangerous. If you see differences there, then there are dangers in the initial starting model. The other question is, once you can do that and you see all these different states, can you refine that to higher resolution? And one thing we wanted to do is maybe can we do that even time resolved? And this was also nicely shown by Alistair yesterday already that this can be done. So we tried that with the ribosome. And what you can do here is we can actually look at translocation. And translocation in a cell means that you have to shift the tRNAs in the ribosome from the A site and P site over to the P and the E site to make this A site free again for the next cycle of elongation where the next amino acid is brought to the ribosome. And in normal, under normal conditions, this is a process that is catalyzed by the elongation factor G in whatever way. And it's very fast. So translocation is a very rapid process and it can not really very nicely be followed by any kinetical step. So it's very badly understood in terms of the details what happens in EFG catalyzed translocation. So it's too fast to be followed by EM as well. But what you can do is you can look at, for example, spontaneous forward translocation. The ribosome doesn't need EFG to do translocation, so you can do that without it. It's just very, very inefficient, and it's not very, very good system. So what has been shown by Marina Rodnina and other labs in a few years ago is that the ribosome can also translocate backwards, so in the retro translocation direction, spontaneously under certain conditions. And this is a very nice process because it runs in 20 minutes to completion. And just by adding a tRNA to this kind of ribosome, then you shift the tRNAs in the backwards direction without any elongation factor. So, and then you can just do time-resolved cryo-EM. You see, you can collect data at different time points. We have done that, and we have prepared our samples not at 4 degrees. We have prepared them at 18 degrees at these different time points, and I will show you in a second why this is. If you try to analyze these things, the question is, we want to see something. We want to see what happens during a functional process. And there was an interesting question. A photographer called Muybridge, he asked that more than 100 years ago. Do horses fly do they lose the contact with their hooves from the ground at any stage during gallop? And this is a question you would never be able to ask in the ground state of your molecule. So you can do interesting studies with this, solving structures of your ground states, and that would give you certainly high resolution, and because this is stable, they don't move much. But it would not help you in understanding the functional intermediates and the short-lived intermediates of the process. So this is the reason why you have to go to higher energy states in order to see what's going on in terms of movement. And that's what the photographer did. He just put cameras in a certain distance, took these photos, and put them all together to create the first movie in history. And that shows exactly that there is a certain moment in time where the horse does lose contact to the crown, and they actually do fly. And it also shows you that it requires a certain conformation to do that. So it's coupled to they don't fly here in this stretched conformation. It requires this conformation. So there's a certain coupling of motions necessary to reach certain states. And this is what we actually wanted to analyze by EM. So if you do that, the horse problem is a single molecule technique. What we can do in cryo-EM is we can go to elevated temperatures to just populate our higher energy states. We are not forced to combine all the images into one structure. We can separate them if we have the tools, and so we can look at this. But the problem is more like that. You have to analyze all the things in parallel, and you have to figure out which one of those is similar to another one in order to understand what's going on. So this is what we have done. We have collected this series of images of the ribosome at these different time points. We have recorded 1.8 million particle images on a CM200 FEG. This is how they look like. If you combine all these images and try to get one single reconstruction, you would say that's good. You have a lot of images. You can get high resolution. You get stuck at 25 angstrom resolution approximately, and you hardly see any tRNAs in the structure because there's just too much motion going on in the complex, and you average out all the interesting fine details. So the question is how many, and that is one question Alistair addressed, how many structures are there? So this is difficult to answer, and we have tried to separate our data set starting from these 1.8 million images, and we have done it in a hierarchical way. So because I think you can't distinguish major modes of motion from small modes of motion in the same step of the analysis. So we first look for the major modes of motion in the ribosome, and that is the 30S subunit rotation. And then we went on looking at the 30S subunit head position in the structure using other techniques that use bootstrap 3D volumes and 3D MSA. That was shown by Bruno Klarholz and by Paul. So we used exactly those methods to analyze this. And then you can, later on, you can even look for smaller differences in the tRNA densities. And what we did is we came up with 50 different structures out of these 1.8 million images. This is a statistical thing. We could probably have done that even finer, but then you would need even more data to do that. So it's a practical limitation, basically. So the way we did that is, in the first step, you have these different rotation angles of the 30S subunit. So we modeled that. So, but we modeled that in a way that we rotated the 30S subunit around an axis that we already know in the ribosome. We know it was wrong. It was not the right axis to rotate the 30S subunit. But we did it, and we grouped all the images according to the correlation coefficient. And then what we did is we wanted to get rid of the model again. So we calculated the 3Ds just using the 50S subunit. No longer any information of the 30S subunit was present to calculate these 3Ds. And that gives you new structures where you have, again, all these different 30S subunits. And then you can redefine the position of the axis, of the tilt axis. And you can do that a few times. And then we ended up here. And this is actually the position that was shown by EM and by X-ray, that this is actually the right rotation center for the 30S subunit. So we did model it, but we tried to get rid of the model by this step of using an omit map where we took off the information of the 30S subunit completely. Then we did this bootstrapping. We calculated 10,000 of different 3Ds using our data sets, and then we looked at them by 3D MSA in confined areas. So we looked at it at first in the 30S head region, only for the variations in here, and then in the next step, only for the variations in the tRNA region. And this was, again, the 3Ds were calculated without using these modeled or these regions of interest. So we left that out again in the 3D structural calculation. And this is what comes out. So we have 50 structures. The highest resolution structure is this here. So the original data set was limited to about 25 angstrom resolution. So we went down to about 8.8 or to 9 angstrom resolution. And only 25,000 particle images went into this structure. So it, and you see it's a rather isotropic resolution. There's we resolve structural details in the center as well as at the outside of the surface of the ribosome. We can clearly see all the double helical elements. This here is an alpha helix of S16. So it's a pretty nice resolution. But what is also important is we get all these minor populations, and this is only 25,000 images of the whole data set. And that shows you tRNAs in completely different positions and in positions that have never been seen before. Of course, this is limited in resolution, but it's only 0.2% of all images. And you still see a fully defined P-site tRNA and a tRNA at the very outermost site of the 50S subunit. So it's a very transient state, but still we can track these kind of states. And looking at all the states together, what you can do then is you can just play them. And this is not a morphing movie. This is just playing one state after the other at a speed so that it makes up a movie in your brain. And then you can see how tRNAs move from the A site to the P site and the E site during the whole process. And what you see is that you see all these contacts that change. You can follow all these dynamical movements of the tRNA and the tRNA ribosome contacts in this data. So, and this is not only the only information you can extract. What you can also do is you can follow this motion of the tRNAs, but this motion is like in the horse case. It's not. It's associated. It's coupled to motions in the ribosome. So what you see here is when the tRNAs move, the whole conformation of the ribosome is also affected. And you can analyze that in very great detail by looking at all these rotation angles of the 30S subunit, and how this information is coupled. So we have certain tRNA binding states that are shown here, and then you can plot that, how this is coupled to 30S body and head rotation. So you can get an entire landscape of your conformational landscape of your ribosome during the translocation pathway. And then you can also see that there's a freedom for different conformations when you have just very specified tRNA conformations. So you can extract a lot of important information. So when tRNAs move to hybrid sites binding, so that was already shown by Joachim Frank, that the first step is you have A and P side bound tRNAs, and then they move to these hybrid bound positions, that this is really coupled with changes in the 30S subunit dynamics. So you can also analyze the overall populations, how they change over time. So you can analyze, you can actually do bulk kinetics with this data, and the biochemical kinetics data is very much similar to what we have just done using only the structural data and followed the tRNA position. So the ribosome, that gives very similar data. In addition to that, bulk kinetics, what we can do is we can follow population statistics and look at the individual populations and the kinetic rates of the individual populations. So that also is shown here, that this is the same over time. But you also see we have certain states that are heavily populated, and they are lowly populated, and so we have differently populated states. And
Holger, so did you use information like this in the classification?
No.
Did you not classify earlier or late images?
No, nothing. No. All in one. Yes. And then this is analyzing all the positions. So if you have a particle here I should go to the next plot. So what we have done here is now we have looked at in the previous plot, this was all the pre-1 particles at a given time point calculated with respect to all the particles at this time point. And so if you do it now like this, that you calculate all the pre-translocation particle at this state with only the pre-translocational particles, then you see that the ratio doesn't change over time, and that is also true for the post-translocational particles. So what we can detect here is that we have very fast equilibration between all the pre-states. All the pre-states are always at the same ratio, and all the post-states are always at the same ratio. So we can convert that into equilibration rates, and that means we can detect all these. We can measure these K values, and we can detect the rate-limiting step of the translocation reaction just by looking at our data. And the rate-limiting step is exactly this, from the pre-5 to this post-1 position, and that is the reaction where you have to remove the tRNAs from the 30S subunit on the 30S subunit side together with the mRNA and move them over into the P&E positions. So that's exactly this step. So you can do an awful lot of things with this kind of information. What you can also do is you can translate this into free energies. So we have translated these different populations into free energy levels, and you get a landscape. We still need to improve that plot. It's a bit difficult. But what it actually tells you is that you have this free energy landscape of the ribosome during, this is just during hybrid site tRNA formation. And what you see here, plotted onto this curve, is just the possible conformational orientations of the ribosome in this particular tRNA binding state. That's this here. Then you have in red, this red one here. This one is the orange two parts, and then those two are here. So you can see that you have these different landscape for ribosomes with those tRNAs bound in this state, and that they have to even climb up over small hills in the energy landscape. The funny thing, or the interesting thing, is that these little steps that we see, they just correspond to about KT. So, and this is actually what you expect, because you have a spontaneous process that is just driven by temperature, and then all these individual steps should be overcome by just the thermal energy in the system. And I think that is an important point that is very interesting for I think all of us to address. And Alistair has already mentioned that yesterday. We can not only prepare our samples at 4 degrees like most of us are doing, or 18 degrees, we can do it at 37 or at 60 or whatever degree before freezing. And so if you do that with a ribosome, you can actually see that if you do that at 4 degrees and average all molecules, no computational sorting, a ribosome still looks fine. And this is what has been done so many times already. So you see the RNA twists and everything. So it's at about 10, 11 angstrom resolution. You nicely resolved structure. This will now slowly morph into structures that have been recorded at 18 degrees and at 37 degrees. And what you see is at 18 degrees, you have a 30S subunit tilt, and at 37 degrees, we lose almost the entire 30S subunit density because there's so much motion that we can't even get a single reconstruction anymore. And that is the reason why we have analyzed our data at 18 degrees, because there's already enough dynamics. At 37 degrees, what we ought to do and ought to understand, this is currently beyond of what we can do because of the image statistics and our tools, but I think this is what we want to do in the future. We have also analyzed this in more detail. So if you look at this 30S subunit motion in terms of rotation of the 30S subunit, and you do that at 4 degrees, you clearly see this peak at no rotation angle. The majority of particles are there, and this is the major state that we see in all these reconstructions. But at 18 degrees, you already see it. You see this second peak here of higher rotations. That's why in the movie the 30S subunit was rotating towards you. And at 37 degrees, what we see is an almost flat distribution of all the possible angles. And that is actually what is needed. At 37 degrees, the ribosome has to sample all the possible conformational states. Otherwise, it would not be a spontaneous process. So it's a completely flat energy landscape. And one interesting aspect might be that you have this chemical versus thermal energy, and this is published in this very nice review here. If you look at the energy in a cell, then you see that if you have a molecular motor that consumes about 100 to 1,000 ATPs per second, that corresponds to a chemical power of 10 to the minus 16, 10 to the minus 17 watt. And if you look at the same time what happens in 1 second in terms of thermal energy, so there's a thermal noise power of 10 to the minus 8 watt at the same time. And that means the thermal noise power is 8 to 9 orders of magnitude higher than the chemical power in your system. And that actually means that we have to think probably about many of these machines that we are talking about as Brownian motors that can really make use of the thermal energy, convert it into directed motions like we have seen for the ribosome. And this is one reason why we should really start to analyze our structures and do all these structural analysis at higher temperatures, analyze these kind of motions in order to understand what's really going on in these systems. So, there's just one. I think, maybe all macromolecular machines are, in fact, thermal machines because of this relation of chemical. And if that is true, or was true, then all these conformational transitions, they are sort of micro-ratchets that you need for a Brownian machine to work, because you have only these, you can only overcome these tiny little barriers in the energy potential, and the energy and the potential needs also to be asymmetric. So this is just the principle of a Brownian motor. And I think we really need to study these complexes at higher temperature in order to understand that. So one summary is, I think we need to, when we start these macromolecules, and I mentioned that, we need really the simultaneous analysis of the variability and the initial structural model. There is no, in the majority of these, at least asymmetric and really dynamic complexes, there is no single solution to the problem. You can also do this time-resolved structure analysis, and in our case, we can do that at a level of better than 1 nanometer resolution, even looking at at structural differences and visualizing structural differences that are at around 1% of the a tRNA is only 1% of the density of a whole ribosome. And all this coupling information of what is moving in a complex really tells you about the functionally important aspects. You can even determine kinetic rate constants, equilibrium constants, and you can study the temperature dependence of the dynamics of the system. So this is what I think should be very nice to be done. If you look at small complex, the problems are pretty much the same, I expect. And the problem is that it's just more difficult to get images and just more difficult to address these kinds of small differences in the initial phase. And so it will be very difficult to get a reliable structure where you can feel yourself really confident that what you get is a true structure if you cannot analyze this motion, at least for these asymmetric complexes. If you have symmetry, things help. If you have a nicely shaped complex, this also helps. If it's spherical, it's dangerous. The sample quantity is a problem. If you have a tendency to aggregate and the molecule is small, very dangerous. And of course, the image quality, you need a good signal. And those things that we have heard about may really help in the future. So that's actually what I wanted to say. I think I run over time already tremendously. I have a few more slides. So if you're interested in some data of the... should I stop? Some data of the thing. So we have a CS corrector. And many people think it's stupid to have a CS corrector. And this is might be true, might be not. But I think it's worth trying. And if you look at the theoretical CDF curves of with CS0 in red and CS of 3 millimeter, which is quite normal, then you see they largely overlap. You have even more zeros to deal with at the same defocus when you have a CS corrector. No difference in amplitudes. Even in the theory, you have even sometimes slightly bit higher amplitudes if you have CS of 3 millimeter. So why using that? And it's a good question. Why using that? We have done some experiments in Eindhoven a few years ago with a material science microscope and saw that there might be some beneficial aspects to the CS corrector. But it was difficult to test everything without having a cryo machine. So now we have these CS corrected cryos in place. It really works very nicely. It's very, very stable. Also, the CS corrector is a very easy to handle tool. So it's such a complicated optics, but it's very simple to use. It's very stable over time. So it doesn't bother us at all in our everyday work. Even if there would be no contribution, to, it doesn't bother you. and you can you can use now this machine. We can do automated particle collection. We can, if we extrapolate, you can get about 1 million particles, 1 terabyte per week. So you have to worry about other computational aspects. But this is not what I want to talk about. This is actually how the system. Here's the autoloader. Here is the CS corrector of the microscope. And so the question is, and I think many people were concerned about what's the contrast in cryo if you use a CS corrector. So what do you expect at relatively close to focus, low dose images at CS0, 300 kilovolt on a CCD camera? So this is what we got for ribosomes. And this is at about 0.9 micron defocus. We can even go down to 0.6, 0.5 micrometer defocus and still see ribosomes very, very nicely in cryo. So this is something I can really say for sure. There's no loss in contrast using a CS corrector, and we can still work at very similar defocus values like we were used to work all the time. So this is something that is clear. And what it also... what was also surprising is that these kind of images, when we took them and using many different samples already, they always were Rob. I thought crispy. Rob had said, and it's shiny is the right word probably. So they're sort of these shiny images that we are all aiming for, maybe. So if we do image analysis, and it's just using 5,000 images, you see it's lots of individual details. They behave very well during image analysis and alignment and classification. So everything seems to be fine. The question is, what does it really do, the CS corrector? And if you, we did some tests already. So this is just looking at blood in iridium foils and looking at the power spectra of the of blood in iridium. And this is a bit confusing because there's three curves overlaying. But you see the black one is with the CS corrector on and has many ripples here. The CS corrector off in blue and red at different coma values, just to see that there's no difference in coma. So we see more tone rings, and just a close-up view shows you that the CTF is really very nice. This is about two extremes, so between two and one extreme, we clearly still see all the CTF ripples and it is mostly limited by the camera because we are very close to Nyquist already in here. So it shows clearly very well-defined tone rings and is in that sense better than without the CS corrector. But it doesn't explain the difference in that we thought are there when you look at these cryo images, that they are so crispy. And we thought we had to look for, if there's no difference in amplitude, the only other thing I thought of is we may look at the difference in phases of the images. And we did just measurements of the C film, of a carbon film. And the way we did it, we just recorded 10 images of the same area, same illumination, same count on the camera, with CS corrector on and off. Did that three times. In each series, we aligned image one with respect to image two with respect to image three, and so on. And then we calculated the differential phase residual between these aligned image pairs, averaged all these differential phase residuals, and this is to get more statistics, and this is the kind of curve we get. So what it looks like is that the blue curve is with the CS corrector off, and the red curve is with CS corrector on. And we think that we can get about 2 to 7 degrees lower phase errors, but not only in the high resolution range, also in the intermediate resolution range. And if that is true, it should also help us in normal image analysis already with our single particle images. And this is what we have then tried to do. I have collected two data sets on the same grid of the ribosome that you have just seen without the CS corrector and with the CS corrector, and only recorded 5,000 images. And initially, I thought this is useless because you would never, I expected just to see anything here at high resolution. So I thought it's not really useful, this data. But if there is some changes in here, we should also see differences even with 5,000 images. And this is, in fact, what you can see. So if we analyze all these 5,000 images with CS corrector on and off, and do the same multi-reference alignment, do the same classification into 250 classes, and then we have calculated all the Fourier ring correlation functions for all these 250 classes in both cases and averaged all of these differential phase residuals, and this is the averaged curve of all these differential phase residuals. Then you see that it is higher when you're when the hexapoles, the CS corrector is on. This is not a very sensitive test, but it shows that there is an improvement in alignment and classification, at least in this data set. And then we have tried to model the effect that we have seen previously. So if you have a phase error of 6 degrees, we have just used the data that we have recorded with the CS corrector off on and have Fourier transformed all the images and then increased or randomized the phases in certain discrete steps of phase errors. And then we could model that in order to come from this curve, the red curve, to the blue curve down, this corresponds to a phase error of 6 degrees, which very nicely fits to at least what we have measured here on the C film. So it agrees well. The other question is, how can we explain that? This is very, very difficult. One thing, that's still pretty much work in progress, but what you have with the CS corrector is you have you have not only a very well aligned microscope, because coma is really not affecting anything beyond one angstrom resolution. Lower than one angstrom resolution, you may have phase errors, but with a CS corrector, you don't have any problems with coma at the level of resolution we are interested in, while this is not always true with the coma-free alignments that we have in our normal microscopes. And then we have significantly lower, higher-order aberrations that also add up, may add up. So we have, of course, the CS corrector brings down not only the coma, but also all higher-order aberrations up to the fifth-order aberrations go down. That may contribute. And we have significantly lower off-axis aberrations. That means over the field of view, you have smaller aberrations when you have a CS corrector. Whether this is the case or explains all these effects, I don't know yet. It might be difficult to figure that out in detail, but it's at least a difference between the two systems. And the other thing is that if you have a CS corrector, you can, if you have no CS corrector, then any scattering angles of higher than 10 millirad approximately, they can now properly be brought back to the place where they should be, these electrons. And with a CS corrector, this can really bundle high scattering electrons and bring them back to their origin. So this may help to reduce the noise level in the images, but we still have to experimentally verify this. So there are physical differences that are, these things don't enter the normal CTF transfer function calculations usually, and whether they really influence that is still something to show. But from our experiments, what we have so far seen is all these cryo images are just, they just look different, and they are very nice and can be really very nicely used for alignment and classification. So I think that's all I wanted to tell you. Thanks.